Humpty Dumpty, Humpty Dumpty, Humpty Dumpty, Humpty Dumpty.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here on election day. I'll bet you were up before dawn getting ready to go out there and vote. It's a real carnival. It is a real carnival if you tune across different television stations. And on New York's Madison Square Garden. Oh, no, not Madison Square Garden. Times Square. Surprisingly, the guy that sells T-shirts there is selling about 50 a day of Donald Trump and none of Hillary. Anyhow, we know what to expect. Like I've said, I say Hillary's going to win unless there's something really weird happens. And if she doesn't win the popular vote, she'll win the Electoral College. That's where the fixer is. That's where the ruling class is very well defended. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations, and thank you. A lot of you guys are getting your donations in, gals getting them in early. That's good. Appreciate that. So we can pay the bills around the bunker here. Yeah. So I've got a guest editorial here we're going to run. I don't know whether you'll agree with everything on it, but I thought it was pretty good. So here we go with a guest editorial.
Sometimes would watch things that would make us think that blacks were the real racists and other elementary thoughts like this, but there was no real understanding behind it. The event that truly awakened me was the Trayvon Martin case. I kept hearing and seeing his name, and eventually I decided to look him up. I read the Wikipedia article, and right away I was unable to understand what the big deal was. It was obvious that Zimmerman was in the right. But more importantly, this prompted me to type in the words black on white crime into Google, and I have never been the same since that day. The first website I came to was the Council of Conservative Citizens. There were pages upon pages of these brutal black-on-white murders. I was in disbelief. At this moment I realized that something was very wrong. How could the news be blowing up the Trayvon Martin case while hundreds of these black-on-white murders got ignored? From this point I researched deeper and found out what was happening in Europe. I saw that the same things were happening in England and France, and in all the other Western European countries. Again, I found myself in disbelief. As an American, we are taught to accept living in the melting pot, and black and other minorities have just as much right to be here as we do, since we are all immigrants. But Europe is the homeland of white people, and in many ways the situation is even worse there. From here I found out about the Jewish problem and other issues facing our race, and I can say today that I am completely racially aware. Blacks. I think it is fitting to start off with the group I have the most real life experience with, and the group that is the biggest problem for Americans. Niggers are stupid and violent. At the same time, they have the capacity to be very slick. Black people view everything through a racial lens. That's what racial awareness is. It's viewing everything that happens through a racial lens. They are always thinking about the fact that they are black. This is part of the reason they get offended so easily, and think that something are intended to be racist towards them. Even when a white person wouldn't be thinking about race. The other reason is the Jewish agitation of the black race. Black people are racially aware almost from birth, but white people on average don't think about race in their daily lives. And this is our problem. We need to end. Have to. Say you were to witness a dog being beat by a man. You are almost surely going to feel very sorry for that dog. But then say you were to witness a dog biting a man. You will most likely not feel the same pity you felt for the dog for the man. Why? Because dogs are lower than men. This same analogy applies to black and white relations. Even today, blacks are subconsciously viewed by white people as lower beings. They are held to a lower standard in general. This is why they are able to get away with things like obnoxious behavior in public, because it is expected of them. Modern history classes instill a subconscious white superiority complex in whites and an inferiority complex in blacks. This white superiority complex that comes from learning of how we dominated other peoples is also part of the problem I have just mentioned. But of course I don't deny that we are in fact superior. I wish with a passion that niggers were treated terribly throughout history by whites, that every white person had an ancestor who owned slaves, that segregation was an evil and oppressive institution, and so on. Because if it was all it true, it would make it so much easier for me to accept our current situation. But it isn't true. None of it is. We are told to accept what is happening to us because of ancestors' wrong doing, but it is all based on historical lies, exaggerations, and myths. I have tried endlessly to think of reasons we deserve this, and I have only came back more irritated because there are no reasons. Only a fourth to a third of people in the South owned even one slave. Yet every white person is treated as if they had a slave-owning ancestor. This applies to in the states where slavery never existed, as well as people whose families immigrated after slavery was abolished. I have read hundreds of slaves' narratives from my state, and almost all of them were positive. One sticks out in my mind where an old ex-slave recounted how the day his mistress died was one of the saddest days of his life. And in many of these narratives the slaves told of how their masters didn't even allow whipping on his plantation. Segregation was not a bad thing. It was a defensive measure. Segregation did not exist to hold back Negroes. It existed to protect us from them. And I mean that in multiple ways. Not only did it protect us from having to interact with them, and from being physically harmed by them, but it protected us from being brought down to their level. Integration has done nothing but bring whites down to level of brute animals. The best example of this is obviously our school system. Now white parents are forced to move to the suburbs to send their children to good schools. But what constitutes a good school? The fact is that how good a school is considered directly corresponds to how white it is. I hate with a passion the whole idea of the suburbs. To me it represents nothing but scared white people running. Running because they are too weak, scared, and brainwashed to fight. Why should we have to flee the cities we created for the security of the suburbs? Why are the suburbs secure in the first place? because they are white. The pathetic part is that these white people don't even admit to themselves why they are moving. They tell themselves it is for better schools or simply to live in a nicer neighborhood. But it is honestly just a way to escape niggers and other minorities. But what about the white people that are left behind? What about the white children who, because of school zoning laws, are forced to go to a school that is 90% black? Do we really think that that white kid will be able to go one day without being picked on for being white, or called a white boy? And who is fighting for him? Who is fighting for these white people forced by economic circumstances to live among Negroes? No one, but someone has to. Here I would also like to touch on the idea of a Northwest Front. I think this idea is beyond stupid. Why should I, for example, give up the beauty and history of my state to go to the Northwest? To me, the whole idea just parallels the concept of white people running to the suburbs. The whole idea is pathetic and just another way to run from the problem without facing it. Some people feel as though the South is beyond saving, that we have too many blacks here. To this I say, look at history. The South had a higher ratio of blacks when we were holding them as slaves. Look at South Africa, and how such a small minority held the black in apartheid for years and years. Speaking of South Africa, if anyone thinks that thing will eventually just change for the better, consider how in South Africa they have affirmative action for the black population that makes up 80% of the population. It is far from being too late for America or Europe. I believe that even if we made up only 30% of the population, we could take it back completely. But by no means should we wait any longer to take drastic action. Anyone who thinks that white and black people look as different as we do on the outside, but are somehow magically the same on the inside, is delusional. How could our faces, skin, hair, and body structure all be different, but our brains be exactly the same? This is the nonsense we are led to believe. Negroes have lower IQs, lower impulse control, and higher testosterone levels. In generals, these three things alone are a recipe for violent behavior. If a scientist publishes a paper on the differences between the races in Western Europe or Americans, he can expect to lose his job. There are personality traits within human families, and within different breeds of cats or dogs, so why not within the races? A horse and a donkey can breed and make a mule, but they are still two completely different animals. Just because we can breed with the other races doesn't make us the same. In a modern history class, it is always emphasized that, when talking about bad things whites have done in history, they were white. But when we learn about the numerous, almost countless wonderful things whites have done, it is never pointed out that these people were white. Yet when we learn about anything important done by a black person in history, it is always pointed out repeatedly that they were black. For example, when we learn about how George Washington Carver was the first nigger smart enough to open a peanut On another subject, I want to say this. Many white people feel as though they don't have a unique culture. The reason for this is that white culture is world culture. I don't mean that our culture is made up of other cultures, I mean that our culture has been adopted by everyone in the world. This makes us feel as though our culture isn't special or unique. Say, for example, that every businessman in the world wore a kimono, that every skyscraper was in the shape of a pagoda, that every door was a sliding one, and that everyone ate every meal with chopsticks. This would probably make a Japanese man feel as though he had no unique traditional culture. I have noticed a great disdain for race mixing white women within the white nationalists community, bordering on insanity. These women are victims, and they can be saved. Stop. Jews. Unlike many white nationalists, I am of the opinion that the majority of American and European Jews are white. In my opinion, the issues with Jews is not their blood, but their identity. I think that if we could somehow destroy the Jewish identity, then they wouldn't cause much of a problem. The problem is that Jews look white, and in many cases are white, yet they see themselves as minorities. Just like niggers, most Jews are always thinking about the fact that they are Jewish. The other issue is that they network. If we could somehow turn every Jew blue for 24 hours, I think there would be a mass awakening, because people would be able to see plainly what is going on. I don't pretend to understand why Jews do what they do. They are enigma. Hispanics. Hispanics are obviously a huge problem for Americans. But there are good Hispanics and bad Hispanics. I remember while watching Hispanic television stations, the shows and even the commercials were more white than our own. They have respect for white beauty, and a good portion of Hispanics are white. It is a well-known fact that white Hispanics make up the elite of most Hispanics countries. There is good white blood were height saving in Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, and even Brazil. But they are still our enemies. East Asians. I have great respect for the East Asian races. Even if we were to go extinct, they could carry something on. They are by nature very racist and could be great allies of the white race. I am not opposed at all to allies with the Northeast Asian races. Patriotism. I hate the sight of the American flag. Modern American patriotism is an absolute joke. People pretending like they have something to be proud while white people are being murdered daily in the streets. Many veterans believe we owe them something for protecting our way of life or protecting our freedom. But I'm not sure what way of life they are talking about. How about we protect the white race and stop fighting for the Jews? I will say this though. I myself would have rather lived in 1940s American than Nazi Germany, and no, this is not ignorance speaking, it is just my opinion. So I don't blame the veterans of any wars up until after Vietnam, because at least they had an American to be proud of and fight for. An explanation. To take a saying from a film, I see all this stuff going on, and I don't see anyone doing anything about it. and it pisses me off. To take a saying from my favorite film, even if my life is worth less than a speck of dirt, I want to use it for the good of society. I have no choice. I am not in the position to, alone, go into the ghetto and fight. I chose Charleston because it is most historic city in my state, and at one time had the highest ratio of blacks to whites in the country. We have no skinheads, no real KKK, no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world, and I guess that has to be me. Unfortunately, at the time of writing, I am in a great hurry, and some of my best thoughts, actually many of them, have been to be left out and lost forever. But I believe enough great white minds are out there already. Please forgive any typos, I didn't have time to check it.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. I think that's a pretty good article. And it's, I don't even know who the guy was that sent it to me, but it should get around, and those are the thoughts that we all have, I hope. Well, anyhow, I'm going to cut it short today and get back to the YouTube a little bit and the radio, just to keep an eye open. They got the most police they've ever had in Times Square tonight for a Hillary celebration. What a time for ISIS or anybody else. You never know what's going to happen now. Maybe the militias out there will start something off today or tonight. Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? Terrible Tommy off and clear. I'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow is Wotan's Day, right? Oh, incidentally, I'm going to play back a recording of an interview that took place in southern Louisiana a couple of days ago between a couple of journalists. And one guy had actually run against David Duke in one of the campaigns that he was in. And this gives you a little bit of idea of the way the Duke campaign is going.
This is Steve Sabadeski, publisher of AudioBuzz.com. And today we have a special guest, Tom Bridges, who writes for The Advocate and who is just, penned an article for Politico. Has written two books about David Duke. He's and we're going to talk about that right now. We're going to talk about the U.S. Senate election, about the two books that he wrote about David Duke, and an upcoming book that he just co-authored and that will be coming out. So, good morning, Tyler. How are you doing today?
Great, Steve. Makes me feel like I've done a lot of writing. All that intro.
Oh, yeah, absolutely have. So, why don't you tell us, first of all, I saw the article, read it yesterday and this morning, and it was really interesting, especially given the fact that, two books that you did write. So, why don't you just give us a brief background about the article that appeared in Politico that we actually put up on a newsletter yesterday sent out.
Okay, well, great. I'm glad for the publicity. Yeah, it's a piece. It's for Politico Weekly, which is their weekly magazine, and the article was posted on Friday. And as you mentioned, I have written a lot about David Duke over the years. In fact, I'm his biographer. My first book is called The Rise of David Duke, as you know, and you and I got to know each other back in 89-90 when you were one of the people who was opposing David Duke, and I was covering him very closely for the Times-Picayune newspaper. And, I did a lot of investigative writing over the years on him and chronicled his political rise, and that's what led to The Rise of David Duke, my book. And then for many years, I didn't follow him. I was out of the state. And then he came back on my radar screen this year when he decided to run for the Senate, and that was really prompted by his support of Donald Trump. And So then I wrote a story for Politico Weekly back in March comparing Trump and Duke. I had gone to a Trump rally in Baton Rouge in February and was very struck how much it reminded me of the David Duke rallies of 1990 and 1991 when, as you remember, he ran for the Senate and then for governor. And Duke really tapped into a movement with his race-based message that drew big, big, adoring crowds. And he raised a lot of money. He was able to do TV ads. And what struck me is that's all gone, or mostly gone. He, in this race for the Senate, as I write it for Politico Weekly, he hasn't had any big rallies. He's finally been able to raise enough money to advertise kind of bare bones TV ad. His hope is he will make the runoff. And if he did, it would be a national story. But you'll remember that he qualified 2 weeks ago for that debate at Dillard this past Wednesday night. He qualified for that debate by getting 5.1%, with the minimum to qualify was 5%. And that was the highest he'd gotten in any poll. So the polls would have to be off by a huge, huge magnitude for Duke to qualify for the runoff. He would need about 22-23%, I'm guessing, to make the runoff. And he claims he's underpolling. There is evidence of underpolling in the past, but there's no evidence that it would be of the magnitude that he would need to qualify for the runoff.
Yeah, I watched his appearance at the debate, and he says he won, and you reported that he said that he won.
I didn't say that he'd won.
No, that he said that he won.
Oh, yeah, he said that he won, right. Yeah, I think a lot of people would be turned off by him. It was a very unusual thing he did right after the debate began, where he got in an argument with John Snell. And I've known John Snell for a long time, and he's done a lot of these debates. He's a very even-handed, unflappable guy. And to get in an argument with John Snell is pretty amazing. But I think from David Duke's point of view, Steve, it was probably deliberate on his part. I think he was angry that he felt like he wasn't getting his chance to ask address a question.
Right.
But if you want to go to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. and disrupt things, and that's what all the candidates are saying. They're all saying, I'm an outsider. It won't be business as usual with me in Washington. Well, David Duke showed on that debate stage that he is a disruptor. And if he went to Washington, he would be a disruptive force. And if you're trying to tell people in an anti-Washington mood that you're going to be a disruptor, well, he showed that on the stage Wednesday night.
Yeah, without question. From my view, at least, I think the first altercation was on the Obamacare question. He was attacked by Carolyn Thayer, and he wanted to respond, and he also wanted to answer the Obamacare question, and Snell tried to put it all together within his 1 minute or 2 minute time frame, and he got upset about that. And I guess do you think he got any mileage out of it? I mean, because obviously the key issue for a lot of people, including Donald Trump, is being a disruptor, and that plays very well.
I think any time there's a microphone in front of David Duke's face. I'm sorry, I just said any time, but I would say almost any time it's beneficial for him. He will turn off a lot of people, and that's why he's only one race out of, seven or eight or nine that he's run. People who want deep-seated change, people who think the system is rigged, people who like his white identity, race-based message, that narrow slice of the electorate will respond favorably to his message. So You know, David Duke's a very, very intelligent guy. You may not like him, his views, but he is an intelligent guy. And I think he had a clear message that he was trying to deliver in that debate Wednesday night, and I think he did deliver it.
Yeah, he did. You know, there was a sort of like a theme to the poll that is kind of like, we'll say the rise and fall of, in the sense of David Duke. It wasn't really a fall, but...
Well, certainly it's a fall from the days when you were one of those people opposing him 25 years ago in the Louisiana Coalition Against Nazism and Racism was opposing him. I wrote my book, published in 1994, I deliberately called it The Rise of David Duke because I always thought there was going to be the chance for a political comeback. There's so many people in this country's history who've been written off, who made comebacks, and I always thought there was that possibility. And I've drawn the conclusion after talking to Duke, after talking to his people, after covering this campaign, the Advocate newspaper, that we are now seeing the fall, that we're now seeing David Duke's last stand. And that's what I lay out in the Political Weekly article.
Right. I was going to say that in viewing Duke on TV the other night, it looked to me like he was almost reverting to where he was when he first started. You know, it seemed...
I think that's a very interesting observation. You know, back in the 70s when he was in the Klan, and then the 1980s when... the group that he created, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, he could be very disruptive, trying to bring attention to himself, and would get upset easily. Mm-hmm. We did not see that in 1990 and 1991. He was not as disruptive. You know, I went off to those rallies of his, and they were very sort of calm affairs in the message that he delivered. Now people would get excited, they would chant his name. But maybe more in these polarized times, he's gone back to more of that kind of a message, or maybe just that he's not practiced. He went to maybe two or three campaign forums that people tried to shut him out of the other ones. Mm-hmm. He had not participated in the first debate. He did not qualify. And I'm guessing that in 1990 and 1991, when he again ran for the Senate and for governor, he was very practiced at how he delivered his message, and also dealing with insults or perceived insults. And he's probably out of practice.
He was actually screaming. I mean, that's something I've never seen, you know, of him. And I just thought that was so bizarre, and gets to what you're referring to, you know, not polished at all. Maybe out of practice. So, at the end of the debate, everybody else dispersed.
Well, they came into the media room.
Yeah, but while he was still at the podium there.
Yeah. Just so your readers know, or your viewers know this, the debate at Dillard took place in what's called George's Auditorium, named after the John George, the owner of the Advocate newspaper, and they were allowed to sit in the audience. The public was not allowed, and I think what they were trying to do, Raycom Media, the organizers of the debate, they were trying to prevent anybody standing up and trying to disrupt the event, or through applause, and that's understandable. What I never understood, and nor did any of my journalistic colleagues, is why we were not allowed in the auditorium, the empty auditorium.
Right.
So as soon as the debate ended, I had to quickly file my story. But I did see later that as everyone left the stage, Duke was still there, and his mic was now turned off. The debate was, but he was yelling.
Yeah.
As you said, I think he was yelling at John Snell that he was upset over some things from the debate, and the reason I'm guessing this is because then he immediately came into the press room, and all the other candidates had already come in there, sometimes the spin room, and the candidates were talking to some of the reporters. I was not talking to any of the candidates. I did not want to talk to any of the candidates because I had to very quickly file my story, so I wanted no disruption. And all David came in and David Duke came into the room and started disrupting things. He started shouting and offered his complaints. Some of these things I describe in the article that I wrote for Politico Weekly. And the cameramen and photographers who were paying attention to the other candidates immediately abandoned them for Duke. And I think the other candidates saw Duke, you know, they didn't want to be photographed with him. They didn't want to shake hands with him. So they all immediately left one way or the other, the media room.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we haven't even talked. Meanwhile, outside, there was 50 to 75 protesters, some Dillard students, others not, who had been chanting, trying to get attention for themselves, and then they tried to get in a door to get into the building, I guess, to get into the auditorium, and I think the police did the right thing to keep them out of there, otherwise they would have tried to disrupt the debate, and I don't think that would have been right, but the police twice used pepper spray on those protesters outside. Called them the members of the Black Lives Matter. I don't know who exactly all they were. I know some of them were Dillard students. I know others were not. But so it was wild outside the building, and it was wild inside the building, too.
There's been some criticism of Dillard and, I guess, Raycom for allowing him. I'm just wondering, I know that it was a different, the last televised debate, there was also the 5%, and I think there was, $1 million?
Yeah, each candidate had to raise $1 million. The criticism of Raycom is on several fronts. One is there are people who do not believe that Duke actually qualified for the debate. Again, the threshold was 5%. Mason-Dixon did a poll, and Raycom announced that Duke scored 5.1%. There are people who do not believe that Duke actually scored that. Raycom just wanted to bring Duke into the event so there could be greater attention and publicity and higher ratings. Now, if no one has presented evidence otherwise, I'll assume that Raycom is telling the truth there. Then the debate had already been scheduled to be at Dillard. Now, someone could have thought ahead, hey, David Duke might qualify for how much in advance they made the decision to hold it at Dillard. Now, Duke qualified for the race, late July, and then he qualified for the debate 2 weeks ago, and I think at that point Raycom was in a tough spot, and they knew there was a chance that people would try to disrupt the debate. So I can understand, as I mentioned, the argument that the decision to keep out the general public from the event. That unlike the one at Louisiana Tech 2 weeks ago, where anybody could sit in the hall there, Duke was not there. He had not qualified. It was just the other five candidates. I don't understand, though, why we reporters were not allowed in that big empty auditorium.
But, yeah, I mean, that's definitely strange. You know, somebody mentioned to me that, you know, they should not have allowed him, even though he did qualify. And when that person said that, I was reminded, my own mind at least, of the time back in, was it 89, where Phil Johnson, Channel 4, did an editorial, I think the day before the election or 2 days before the election, denouncing David Duke, I believe it was, and David Duke filed a lawsuit and was allowed to have, 5 minutes of free
airtime. Do you remember something about that? Yeah, here's my attitude on that, Steve. I thought Duke should be allowed to attend any forum that the other candidates are invited to, that there should be the same standard for all of the candidates. And if Duke qualified for that event, I think he had every right to be there. I don't see there's any justification for not allowing him to be at Dillard. And if you don't like David Duke, defeat him in ways that, through democracy. Defeat him through having better ideas. Defeat him by getting your voters out on election day. Defeat him through having better TV commercials. I think that's the better way. Than if you don't like the guy, you know, remember in 1991 he got 670,000 votes. He got something like 55% of the white vote. He's got more votes than any of those candidates on stage, except perhaps John Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
In any of his races. So I think he deserved the right to offer his point of view, and if you don't like it, defeat him.
Right. And actually, that's his mode of operandi, which is to play the victim, and that, you know, he is against everybody, the David and Goliath type of situation that is going, you know, that he's trying to slay the media, slay, you know, the institutions, and so on. He came out pretty strong in terms of his anti-Jewish, although he didn't really, you know, go into like he does on his website, on his radio, etc. He has about a little bit.
Well, what he does is in election season, he doesn't talk about Jews.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, and I know, that's his true deep abiding passion, is that Jews are bent on undermining the white race. And during election season, voters don't get that. They get maybe a racially based message, racially intolerant, talking about affirmative action, minority set-asides, and quotas back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Today, illegal immigration. Duke is, he'll talk about the media. He'll attack the media. I was noticing this morning that on the New York Times website, they had a video how Donald Trump will denounce the media at his rallies, and people in the crowd at his rallies will start yelling things at the media.
Mm-hmm.
So, just like Trump, Duke taps into anti-media feelings. But in Duke's mind, it's the media is controlled by the Jews, and it's part of a conspiracy. In Duke's mind, when he talks about the international banking system, he's talking about the Jews. When he's talking about communists, he believes that you know, he's talking about the Jews. When he's talking about illegal immigration, he really believes that there's a direct conspiracy by Jews to bring in illegal aliens to poison the white gene pool. So his views are where he comes from is very different from Donald Trump, but they do end up at the same place in many issues.
Now, the other day, I read that Donald Trump's son, Eric, made, I think, a remarkable offensive statement about Duke deserving a bullet in his head. Have you seen anything further about that? Or
I have not seen anything further about that. And unfortunately, there have been several different comments, either from the son or from the father, about violence. And again, if you don't like David Duke, defeat him at the ballot box. Defeat him through having better ideas, not through violence.
Funny that Donald Trump really hasn't said anything even close to anything like that, but Eric, the son, did. I just thought that was really kind of interesting. Not that, you know, violence should be a resort for anything. So let's is there anything that I haven't asked you about? Because I wanted to talk about the your new book.
Yeah, just take a minute if we could to do that.
Sure, okay. So, the name of the new book is The Long Shot, am I correct?
I've written a book on last year's 2015 governor's race with Jeremy Alford, a terrific reporter in Baton Rouge. Your inside viewers will know that he replaced John McGinnis.
He's
got a weekly report and writes a column and often appears on TV. So Jeremy and I have just sent off to the printer a book that's called Long Shot, A Senator, A Soldier, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election. And so our book Long Shot will be out in about a month. We have a website, Louisiana Long Shot, if people want to pre-order. And they could contact me and Jeremy. We'll be selling books with autographing them as well. Books can be out in about a month, and you know, great Christmas gift.
Absolutely. I think I'll give one to David Vitter. That's a joke.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay, Tyler Bridges, will definitely do this again prior to or right after the book comes out, and maybe you.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. That's the inside dope on the Duke campaign from right down there southern Louisiana, probably Metairie. I think he's still in Metairie. Well, anyhow, at, you know, it's tough to run for office no matter who you are, so I don't begrudge anybody running for office because it's a miserable job. I know in running for office two or three times that I was so tired and worn out by the time it was over, I just wanted to curl up in a ball and go to sleep. They called Duke a disruptor. Well, that's good. And this politics of today and in the past at certain times, the disruptor is the guy who gets in, you know. So first you disrupt, get the attention, then you get some power, and then you go from there. So there's nothing wrong with that tactic at all, because if you don't scream and yell, nobody's going to hear you. Also, one thing I remember about David Duke when I was working with him way back in 75, when he ran for office in 78, I think it was 76, they were talking about him screaming on this radio show, and I was laughing because back then when Duke got up on the stage to make a speech, he was okay until he had to raise his voice and shout and really make a point. Well, his voice would crack, and he would be, pardon me, Duke, he sounded like a woman. He was shrill as hell, and it was funny. Nobody has any control over what their voice is, but I remember that very well, and it was almost comical. And what else? I guess that's about it I had to comment on. Oh, yeah, the fact that they're saying he's going downhill, because I guess he's only got about 5% of the vote, which that's not bad. I mean, you know, it's something, but he's peaked out. Now what's he going to do? He can't make it running for politics, and he can write books or have them ghostwritten for him, but otherwise he don't have the balls to go into the street. He's a coward when it comes to physical confrontation, so I don't know what he's going to do now, and I'm not going to pay much attention to it myself. I haven't really fought and criticized with these right-wingers and people, leaders like him. I've criticized them some, but they're on their own track. I mean, I'm not on that track. They got their own little right-wing, neocon, conservative, or whatever you want to call it, thing that they're into. They've been into it ever since I was involved way back in the 60s. They're not going to change. So they can understand, I'm not going to bother them. They just got to go on about their business, and I'll go about mine. And remember, no cause is lost as long as there's one person still fighting for it. And Napoleon once was quoted as saying, my cause grows weaker with each person I draw to my banner. Bye.